Connecticut Democrats, or Connecticrats, as they have never been called.
Welcome back to Connecticrats, the CT Dem podcast. We are launching again for 2024. My name is David Kostek.
I'm Grace Carlos.
And I'm Tara Kamen.
Well, we're joining you on a historic week for Connecticut because early voting just started a couple of days ago on Tuesday, March 26th. Some voters somewhere in Connecticut walked into their polling place, most likely their town hall, and cast the very first early ballot. I don't think we'll ever know who that person was, but they did. And the early voting period continues on the 27th, March 28th. There is no early voting on Friday, March 29th, because it's Good Friday and that's a state holiday. But then on Saturday, the 30th. So the 26th, 27th, 28th, and 30th. Did either of you guys go out and early vote?
I haven't yet, but I am planning to.
I did not vote today because I am under the weather and did not want to get others sick at the polling place. But I do plan to go to my town hall tomorrow when I'm refreshed and have the medicine in me, because I've been waiting for a while to be able to go. And I was really devastated that I wasn't able to go today because I was so excited.
That's funny. I'm the same way. I was like, I'm going to early vote the first day it's available. First day came, I'm like, oh, I got to drive up to Hartford, so I can't do it today. But ours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. to let people know. And you can check ctdems.org/early voting for the list of all the polling places. Most towns, it's at the city or town hall. Do you guys feel like you knew what was going to be happening with early voting ahead of time?
I felt like I knew because the Secretary of State's office put out a lot of resources, and through different avenues, I saw a lot of information being shared on Instagram stories. A lot of legislators were sharing information. And as you know, the party also provided opportunities for us to hear directly from the secretary to kind of get a rundown on what to expect and what's going on. And you guys were also able to share those resources with us. And then I'm also on different email lists and the website and things like that. So I felt very informed, although this is new and sometimes can be a little intimidating. I don't feel intimidated to go vote. I feel comfortable. I was able to find where I'm supposed to go in my town, the hours, things like that, what to expect and how it's going to work. So I felt pretty confident going in.
I also felt pretty comfortable going in. I think that there was a lot of really great push on social media and a lot of information available. So it was really great to be able to see that.
And this is, you know, look, I look at this like it's essentially a dry run, right? Like it counts, don't get me wrong, but the presidential primary gives all of the registrars of voters and the other election officials the opportunity to try the system out in a 4-day run to see how early voting goes. And I'm very curious what the numbers end up like. You know, in other states that have been doing this for a long time, significant number. But here we have kind of a low turnout event for starters. And then what's going to happen with the numbers?
Yeah, I'm kind of interested to see that, too. When I was in school, I would always work as a poll worker for different elections, and I was a poll worker for primary elections. So being in a small town already, it's not really overwhelming for primary elections. So I do think it was a good idea to have the primaries for our first dry run, so it's not overbearing for those working the elections and for our registrars. But I am interested to see the turnout. I've been hearing a bunch of different opinions about it and different perspectives, so I can't really gauge like what I expect. I've been hearing people being skeptical and people being excited for the opportunity. So I guess I really won't know until it's over and we get those numbers in.
Do you think that the Democratic primary numbers will be higher than the Republican primary numbers? Percentage-wise, the raw number will be because there's just more Democrats in Connecticut. But do you think the percentages will be higher?
I'm hoping so. I feel like considering last time, it should be a wake-up call that we really need to get out and vote. I know some people might think it's okay to kind of like chill and relax as we're in Connecticut, even for a primary, because we're very confident in who we support. But given past experiences, I feel like us, the Democrats, know it's time to get out there and take it serious and have a good turnout. And so I'm hoping that's how everybody feels across the state.
I would also add that early voting generally, I think across this country has increased turnout for Democrats. And I think that a lot of young people specifically like voting early. So I'm hoping that that would bring up those numbers as well.
Absolutely. And for those who do prefer to vote in person, that'll be next Tuesday, April 2nd. And that's at your normal polling place, wherever that might be. And runs from 8 a.m. or rather 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. So that's like the full day of voting, what you're kind of used to in Connecticut, primary day voting. And, you know, we'll watch the results come in. This year on the Democratic ballot, of course, Joe Biden, I would say at the top of the ballot, but do you actually know where he is on the ballot? There's four candidates. Guess what position he's in?
I literally looked at it this morning because it's in alphabetical order, right?
It's actually drawn randomly. There's like the whole ceremony at the Secretary of State's office. And Joe got the fourth position on the ballot. I still think he'll do okay. I think he's going to pull this one out. But yeah, he's down on the fourth row of the ballot out of the four names. So there are four people you can vote for, and there is an uncommitted option.
And okay. What is the threshold again for uncommitted delegates to being sent to the party's nominating convention?
So that's a 15% threshold, and it works two ways. So we send district-level delegates to the convention, and those are chosen in each of the five congressional districts. And then additionally, we send some at-large delegates who can be from anywhere in the state. So the way it works is if you get 15% in any one congressional district or more, then that candidate or even uncommitted gets allocated one delegate at 15%. There are other thresholds for more delegates, but I don't think it's very realistic to think uncommitted would climb much above that if it hits that threshold at all. And then the same is true statewide. If you hit 15% statewide, then you'd get an at-large delegate allocated to you as well. So you know, the way candidates, when it was Clinton versus Sanders or other races, Obama versus Clinton back in 08, you know, those are allocated proportionally based on how the vote comes in. So there is a threshold of 15%, though. So we'll send some delegates to the convention. We'll figure out who they are once we see the results come in. And if no other candidate or the uncommitted vote gets to 15%, then all of our delegates will go to the winner of the primary.
And do we think that there are any uncommitted delegates that would potentially make it to the party's nominating convention this year?
Well, that gets tricky because what has to happen is that there has to be a caucus of uncommitted people who then choose the individuals who would go to the convention as that delegate if it were to happen. So it's a tricky process. This is all spelled out, by the way, on our delegate selection plan. You can find it by going to ctdems.org, and there's a red bar across the top with all the information about the national convention. Click on that and follow the link to the delegate selection plan. It's spelled out. It's a very lengthy legalese document because, you know, those are the rules, and that's the way these things run. Part of the reason, of course, that we do all these is different people, you know, have different opinions about who our nominee should be. And right now, Joe Biden has locked up the nomination in that in previous contests, he's already gotten enough delegates to get there, of course. So Connecticut is once again, you know, having its primary after the point in time when the nominee is pretty well certain. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you think us having our election kind of when the nomination's pretty certain would discourage people from voting or kind of influence how they vote? Because I feel like that's sometimes a comment that you hear. It's like, why does my vote even matter? So how do you counter those type of comments, especially during a time like this? Like, how, why is it still important for you to go out and cast your vote in the primary, regardless of what it may look like?
I think that especially on the younger side of things, I've really been seeing that my peers have had a lot of political apathy and fatigue, particularly after the pandemic, just because I think so much of news and media has become oversaturated with politics that when it comes down to doing actual things like voting, people are just so tired about hearing about it that they avoid that process at all. But I think that really pushing the message that the only way to change the system is to work with it and vote for it and having that messaging is really important to encourage people to put those feelings aside and get out and vote.
I do think it does have an effect. You know, this year we did move our primary up 3 weeks from it historically has been in the last week of April, and now we're in the first week of April. So that's some improvement. And if we were ever in a situation like 08 or 16, where we're more hotly contested late in the game with major candidates, then yeah, this year is more analogous to 2012, right? The Obama re-election year, where, you know, normally parties renominate their president. Like, that's obviously going to happen. To see contests like the Clinton-Obama one, that one was, you know, I believe Obama carried Connecticut in the primary, but it wasn't overwhelming. I think it was about a 60-40 vote. And so then you get higher turnout and I think more engagement.
Yeah. And I feel like also to Tara's point, when I've been seeing young people all around encouraging other young people to get out and vote and just to get informed and just to make sure, even like putting in to be a delegate for the convention. I think that's why also I'm just really appreciative of the way this information was shared so that everybody was informed and had different ways to access the information. And I also think it was good, even this is like a silly one, but just making it clear that it is a primary election, because again, poll worker experience, sometimes people don't quite grasp like what a primary is and the purpose of it. So I just want to shout out to the Secretary of State's office, because they really did an awesome job with just making sure our Connecticut voters were informed and had access and knew where to go and what to do. It helps young people feel empowered and confident to go out and cast their vote as well.
So you guys are affiliated with Young Democrats and College Democrats, respectively. And Young Democrats, for those listening, if those sound the same to you, Young Democrats are an organization for Dems under the age of 35, and College Democrats are those who are active, you know, enrolled in college. You guys both did some surveys of your constituencies. Why don't you talk about those a little bit and let us know what College Democrats of Connecticut and Young Democrats of Connecticut are thinking about these days. Tara, you're with the College Dems.
So we decided to run an issue survey with our constituency, trying to get a grasp of what college kids within Connecticut really cared about in terms of policies. And we asked everyone to choose kind of three major categories of issues that they were really interested in. And the top three categories that we came back with were affordable college, which is really not surprising given that they're college students. Affordable housing and cost of living, which I thought was really reflective of the current state of our economy and how worried I think young people are about their economic futures.
And on the Young Dem side, what we did was pretty similar. We first had a public hearing at the LOB where our members were able to come and quote unquote testify on which platform they would like us to support. So everybody got the chance to come into a hearing room and kind of go in front as if they were testifying to a committee and share a issue that was important to them that they would like us to prioritize. Then after that, we had our membership vote on the top three issues that were important to them that they would like us to support. And ours were housing justice, transit-oriented development, and racial justice and equity. And so with that, we have been working with House and Senate leadership, meeting with different leaders to advocate for the issues that were important to our members, tracking bills, things like that, and making people aware. Also helping to equip our members with preparing for public hearings, reaching out to legislators and things like that. So it was really a fun and interesting way to kind of get people familiar with testifying for bills that they are supporting or maybe even sometimes against and advocating for themselves as young people, because we kind of want to get them comfortable in that type of space to be able to speak out. Because as you know, last session, we did see a large amount of young people in the LOB and things like that. We want to keep that momentum. So it was a really cool experience and a great way to just hear from our young people and those who were, we had high schoolers, we had college students, we had those that were above college age, because as you know, it is 35 and under. So it's very interesting to see the different issues that were important to such a large group of people.
So, you know, this is great. This is sort of a little bit of a peek behind the curtain as to what goes on in Hartford and at state capitals around the country. You know, this is a perfect example of one way to get involved. So you know, you guys are part of a formal-ish organization, about part of the Democratic Party with your respective organizations. But when you hear this call to testify, when you see if there's something that's of particular interest, young Dems, for those 35 and under, and college Dems, if you're a college student listening to this, are fantastic ways to get directly involved with this stuff. A few of these issues that you mentioned, especially around affordable housing and to a degree transit-oriented development, came up in our sort of priority bills for the Democrats in the House and Senate this year. One of them is a housing bill, right? What is that, SB6?
Yes, SB6.
What does that do?
So it's basically aimed at increasing affordable housing, but the bill also includes provisions such as creating a housing growth fund, allowing housing authorities to build in other towns, and offering tax incentives for converting commercial properties into residential ones. And despite opposition from Republicans, the bill was passed along party lines and now moves to the Senate floor for consideration.
You know, in a few minutes, we're going to hear from Representative Christine Palm on an environmental bill. And we talk a little bit about the frustrations of the on party lines voting that she experiences with her bill and with others. It's a little sad to hear that couldn't attract any Republican support at the committee level. We'll see what happens when it goes to the full House and Senate. Do you think this will actually have an effect on the development of either transit-oriented development or building more housing that this state desperately, desperately needs?
I definitely think that offering tax incentives for converting commercial properties into residential ones is really smart, because I feel like commercial development has been more of a priority in Connecticut for a while rather than building residential ones. So it's nice to see something that would maybe mitigate that inequality and like increase residential opportunities for people.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like recently we've been hearing about how so many people have been moving into Connecticut and coming to Connecticut. So this is obviously in line with just addressing the population that's growing. And I also feel like it might have an effect on transit-oriented development, because I know there's so many people out there that are champions for that. And with housing access becoming more accessible to people and people having more access to housing in many different areas, I feel like naturally it's just going to follow. I mean, we were already kind of going in that way with our rail lines and public transportation as far as buses and stuff like that. I feel like they're already making an effort. And I also like the idea of turning commercial properties into residential properties. Being in the area that I'm in, we do see sometimes there are abandoned commercial properties or just properties that kind of started up and never finished. And I know even in my own town, there are rumors of certain commercial properties being turned into residential properties. So that's kind of an interest down my way, because we're kind of excited to see those types of developments and even just bring more people to the area, because, you know, a little quiet over here in southeastern Connecticut, so it'd be nice, maybe even attract some more young people.
That's funny. Just off the top of my head, when I live in Fairfield County, I don't live too far from the Metro North line, and when drive Metro North through along the coast, and then if you take the spur lines up to Danbury and Waterbury, you see a ton of commercial property adjacent to those rail lines and stations. And building near those stations, attracting housing to those near those stations, just allows more people access to the existing infrastructure we already have. I know we also just added a number of bus routes. And if you think about where bus routes tend to go, same thing. They tend to go along the commercial avenues of cities and towns all over Connecticut. And if we can get it to a point where we're developing those into housing, you see huge success with that in New Britain. And I know... I once toured a site in Beacon Falls that used to be a commercial property that's now apartments. It's just fantastic when it's pulled off. It's long-term. It's hard to do. There's lots at stake, but it would be great if our state got to the point where we're adding lots and lots of housing.
And even something simple that I feel like kind of ties into it, like, for example, in my neighborhood, we don't even have sidewalks. So it's kind of, you don't even have a choice to walk or take your bike or a scooter, whereas when I work in Hartford, you see people on bikes all the time. You see people on scooters all the time. We just, I don't want to say super recent, but not too long ago, got bike lanes in some of our towns. So I feel like this is kind of a very interesting topic for our area because it will bring a lot of changes, but I feel like a lot of positive changes, a lot of changes that a lot of us want, because you can't even take a walk around the neighborhood if you want to because there's no safe space for you to walk. So I'm very excited to see where this goes.
A fair bit of Biden's infrastructure law tries to address that. There's funds set aside. I know Stanford just got a significant grant to develop walkways and greenways going from the train station up alongside, I can't remember the name of the street, but along Mill River Park there, in order to make it much more walkable, to make, you know, walkable cities and bikeable cities are something that we need to move toward, I think, as quickly as possible, because we spent 100 years building car-friendly cities, and now it's a constraint on growth.
Kind of on that note as well, there's also an act near me that's establishing a task force to study the feasibility of developing a multimodal transportation center in Stonington and Groton. And I think that's also really interesting because it's kind of intended to ease traffic congestion. But I'm really interested to see, because the bill doesn't exactly outline what those multimodal transportation centers would look like and kind of what technology might be used in order to develop those.
It's great to see this stuff starting. And of course, it also has you know, enormous impacts on climate. Another major bill that will be going through the House this year and Senate is a priority bill of the House. It's HB 5004. And the lead sponsor is Christine Palm. She was kind enough to join us for a discussion about that. So I talked to her earlier. So let's hear from Representative Palm, our guest this week on Kineticrats, the CT Dems podcast. So we're pleased to welcome to the podcast Representative Christine Palm. She's the rep for the 36th District. That includes Chester, Deep River, Essex, and Haddam. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You're the vice chair of the Environment Committee, and you guys are doing a lot of work this year on a particular bill, the Climate Protection Act. Can you just give us like an overview of what that is and why this is the time to work on the Climate Protection Act?
Sure, I'd love to. Last year was a disappointing year for the Environment Committee. We did some great plant and animal bills, but we didn't address climate change as an overarching issue. This year, with the Speaker's Priority Bill 5004, we are doing four essential things. We're updating the state's Global Warming Solutions Act so that Connecticut is more in line with our neighboring states when it comes to greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. We're creating lots of incentives for businesses and municipalities that pivot to a green economy or sustainable practice. We are setting the stage to transition toward a clean economy in general, including more state accountability, workforce training, long-term policies that will help us wean ourselves from fossil fuel. And then finally, we're supporting and expanding nature-based solutions, which would include such things as protecting old growth forests, which are a great carbon sink, and riparian buffers.
Talk a little bit more about coming into alignment with neighboring states. What's the situation right now? I mean, here in New England, we're pretty physically small states. You know, we got decent populations, but sometimes a criticism lobbed at environmental action at the state level is that we're so small. What can we do? It won't have a big impact. Talk about that alignment.
Yes, that's one of my favorite arguments to argue against. We tout our position as being halfway between Boston and New York as an economic driver. But then when it comes time to do something about particulate matter and poor air quality, we throw our hands up and say, well, gee, we're too small to matter. If charity begins at home, so does environmentalism. And I believe we in government have a duty, moral and legal, to protect our citizens any way we can. And so even if it is a drop in the bucket, and frankly, I consider this bill just a good start. We should be doing far more radical things as a society, as a legislature, as a state government, as business people. We should be way ahead of where we are. So the very least we can do in Connecticut is to match our fellow New England states in this goal to reduce carbon.
you know, at the international level, the Paris Accord set certain targets and goals for the United States and other countries. You know, we had a four-year deviation from our commitment to the Paris Accords. But now at the federal level and effectively international level, we're sort of trying to get back on track with that. I know the Biden administration through the EPA is doing some rulemaking to try to get us there. How does this tie in? How does this proposed bill tie into that in terms of carbon reduction targets, in terms of getting down to a point where we're frankly carbon neutral?
Yeah. So essentially, this is where it gets a little bit wonky. We're trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 65% by 2040, and then have an economy-wide target of net zero by 2050. And I need to remind listeners that net zero does not mean no emissions. It means that we offset the emissions that we do produce by other means, carbon sequestration and such. And again, I think that with the argument that greenhouse gas emissions, and which drives is the major driver of climate change, is not a man-made problem. If ever that needed to be debunked, all we had to look at was COVID, when in 2022, at the height of the pandemic, that was the only year we met our greenhouse gas emissions. And that was because people were staying home. People were not driving around and businesses were shutting down. So that is proof positive in real time that this is driven by humankind and our activities. And when I hear my colleagues talk about how human behavior has nothing to do with carbon emissions, I mean, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, because all you have to do is remember a couple of years ago how clear the skies were when people stayed home. And I'm not advocating that we go back to those times, that people stay home or that businesses shut down. I'm just saying that there's an example of how this is evident, that greenhouse gas emissions can be reduced if we change our behaviors.
If you look back at some of the climate measures, first of all, if you look at the debate around this issue, where it just passed out of committee last week on a partisan vote, and then you go look back at the climate, the Clean Air Act in 2021 and some of the other discussions we've had, Republicans, it seems, often say, look, I'm for the clean environment. Of course I want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, just not now and just not like this. This bill seems to be more about incentives than anything else. Why is this a good one to do this year?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, David, because the strong message I got from leadership and from our policy people was create a bill that can be bipartisan because it will bolster the business community, which is the claim that the Republican caucus uses to fight climate bills. Well, it's too hard on business. It's too onerous on business. This bill is supported by CBIA and by the Sustainable Business Council of Connecticut. And we have any number of business leaders telling us they can't wait to take advantage of what this bill offers. So I would respectfully ask my colleagues, where is your support for business if you are against a bill that is chock-a-block full of tax breaks, incentives, waivers of fees, reimbursement rates that are greater than normal for the business people you claim to care about and protect? And I want to call special attention to farmers, because it's not enough for us in Connecticut to have a nostalgic attitude about our farmers. We love our, you know, native strawberries and our delicious corn. But then when the farmers are decimated by floods and freak freezes, as happened last May 17th, after everything started to blossom out, where is your support for them when they know it's because of climate change? So this is an economic driver. I think more than anything else, more than any bill we've done, this is a bill that will help business. And a really good example, just to put a fine point on it, the Hotel Marcel in New Haven, which is a completely carbon neutral, zero footprint, if you will, business. The owner of that told me that it costs on average $15.50 to heat an occupied hotel room using fossil fuel. He pays $5 an hour through renewable sources. So what business person in his or her right mind wouldn't rather pay $5 an hour than $15.50? That's what this bill does.
At the end of this term, this will be your last term. You've announced that you're stepping down from the legislature. I've been there since 2018. And, talk a little bit about your experience in the legislature, whether it sort of matched what you thought. You know, every year, a new crop of people step up and run for the first time. I think you have an expectation. In what ways did it match your expectation? In which ways did you find maybe some frustration? And what led to your decision to step down after three terms?
Well, both of those things are true. It was far better, more fulfilling, more aspirational, more full of remarkable people than I expected. At the same time, there is more compromise than I expected. I knew that there would be. In fact, when I decided to run for office, one of my sons told me my two biggest challenges would be not to swear so much, which I think I've managed to do.
I've not heard one.
Not yet. The morning is young. And the other thing is to compromise on principles or things I really believe passionately in. And compromise is the name of the game when we are one of 13 states that allows the filibuster. So a lot of our bills have to get moderated, let's say, and modified in order to please our colleagues across the aisle. I will be honest, I have found that frustrating in nature because so often we seem to be working at cross purposes. But I'm a pragmatist and I'm willing to do that, and that's what this bill does. So it was disappointing not to have any Republican votes out of committee because we did exactly what they said they wanted us to do. So that kind of thing has been a disappointment. However, I have personally and with my colleagues managed to accomplish a great many things that I'm very, very proud of. So it has been a wonderful job, avocation, vocation on balance. And I will miss it terribly. It's a roller coaster. So to the part of the question about what am I going to be doing instead, I am first and foremost a writer and a teacher. I was a journalist. I've been a high school teacher, a public speaker, a communications director. And I love those things deeply, and I want to get back to them. And I want to use them in service of advancing policy from sort of the outside. I want to help advocacy groups do a better job navigating the halls of power, if you will, now that I have seen and lived the inside baseball. So that's what I plan to do. Stay in the fight, but from a slightly different angle.
It's going to be a fair number of open seats and a whole lot of close races around the state in races for the state legislature. Everyone is up this year. That's 151 House seats and 36 Senate seats. Wherever you live, please try to find a way to get involved. You can check out mobilize.us, especially into the summer and fall, to find volunteer opportunities, and reach out to your local Democratic town committee if you want to get involved in a local campaign. Christine Palm, thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill out, and thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you, David.
Well, that's just about a wrap on our first 2024 edition of the podcast. We'll be back soon with another edition. And I always want to let people know how you can get involved and what you can do to help Democrats win up and down the ballot this year. It's still, of course, very early. Get out there and vote either early on Thursday or Saturday, or on Tuesday in person at your polling place. Vote in the primary. It's important. And then after that, you can always get involved with local organizations, including College Dems and Young Dems. How do people get involved with College Dems?
If you would like to get involved with College Dems, there's a couple different ways you can do it. Most importantly, if you go to College Dems CT on Instagram, we have our issue survey in our bio. If you would like to let us know what issues are important to you so we can have a better idea of what is important to college students. But then also email the account through the Instagram and we will be able to give you our information for our convention, which is happening in late April, if you'd be interested in attending.
And then for Young Dems?
If you're interested in becoming involved with Young Dems, you can find us at Young Dems CT on all social media platforms. We also have a link to our website in our bio, where you can find information to find your nearest regional chapter and contact information. We also have an interest form available for anyone who's looking to become connected and involved. Again, we're open to everyone ages 35 and under, so please check us out and get connected and get plugged in. We have a lot of regional chapters and regional presidents that are excited to welcome you and get you involved in any way that you can. So again, you can check us out at YoungDemsCT on all social media platforms for more information.
And these organizations will be working closely with the candidates at all levels. Our five members of Congress are all up for re-election this year. Senator Murphy is up for re-election this year. Of course, the Biden and Harris campaign will be in full swing. And Connecticut Dems plan to work closely with our partners in New Hampshire and Pennsylvania. If you are interested in working at the federal level and re-electing Joe Biden, that's the place where, frankly, it's going to matter the most, and the swing states that are closest to us. So please do get involved. One other way you can get involved is to become a delegate to the National Convention. If you watch this on TV and you see like that big shot, all the people, some of whom wear crazy hats or like light up sashes or whatever, get your light up sash. You got plenty of months to do it, but you got to get an application in to express your interest in becoming a delegate. The deadline for that is April 7th. And if you want to get the forms, you can go check out ctdems.org. There is a red banner across the top of the page. Click on that. That'll bring you to the information about the Chicago convention that's happening in August. And all the applications are there for you. Do apply. It's available in many, many languages as well. So if you've got friends or you yourself are more comfortable in another language, you can always check it out in those languages as well. Thank you for joining us here. Tara, great. Thanks for participating. And we'll see you all next time on Kineticrats, the CT Dems podcast.